Dr. Dave Kilcullen, welcome to The Realignment.
Thanks for having me. It's great to finally be on here with you guys.
Yeah, I'm excited to speak with you too. Let's start here. You are a person who served in the Australian military. You are an expert in counterinsurgency. We're going to get into that because the broad topic I'd like to focus on you is this idea of lessons learned from the past 20 years, how Russia's thinking about all these realities. But let's just start with your military assessment with what is happening on the ground in Ukraine right now.
Well, the very big picture is that about a week ago, the Russians threw out the complete playbook that they've been employing for about 20 years, right? So we're in a bit of a new world. For 20 years under Vladimir Putin, the Russians have done incredibly well with this kind of incremental, ambiguous approach, doing just enough to get what they want, but not enough to trigger a major response. And, you know, that's worked well for them in a variety of places. But, you know, this time last week, they threw that out the window and went for the jugular to really try to quickly seize and decapitate the Ukrainian government. That failed on the first day of the war. And now they're into kind of a sledgehammer, you know, like Pac-Man, you know, gobbling their way through Ukrainian cities. And I think what we're going to see from them is the kinds of tactics we saw from them in Aleppo, in Syria, in Grozny, in Chechnya, which bodes very ill for Ukrainian civilians, right? But I think that the big picture sort of macro point that, you know, people that have a life and don't track Russia for a living, right, need to get on board is that this is a major departure from what the Russians have been doing in the past. And we all need to be kind of updating our priors, you know, about what we think is really driving Russia and what's going to happen next.
So let's start with what they have been doing in Aleppo and Grozny and what that means for Ukrainian civilians.
Yeah, so 1994, the opening of the war in Chechnya, the Russians pulled off something rather similar to what we've seen in Ukraine. They pushed a major tank column with some supporting infantry armored vehicles down a main road, 120 vehicles in the lead group, just all of them driving nose to tail down the road, very much like that famous convoy that's been kicking around north of Kyiv for the last few days. They ran into major ambushes in the urban environment. They lost 105 out of 120 vehicles in that first column and lost an entire battalion who got surrounded. It's about 600 guys who got surrounded by Chechen guerrillas and massacred in the center of the city in the railway station of Grozny. And as a result, they backed off, brought up huge firepower, and then just effectively leveled the city, right? It took them 3.5 months to actually capture the city. They went block by block with just really heavy artillery. And, you know, you can illustrate the degree of damage by just one fact point, which is that the Russian headquarters, one of the biggest problems they had when they occupied the city months later was finding an undamaged building in order to put their headquarters in there. And we saw a rather similar approach in Aleppo, where the Syrians and the Russians initially tried to push into the city and got smacked. And so they engaged in sort of modern siege warfare tactics and effectively reduced the city to rubble over months in order to control it. So I think the risk for Ukrainian civilians now is that the Russians revert to that Grozny Aleppo playbook and they just reduce these cities to smoking hulks while simultaneously running various efforts to try to still decapitate the current Ukrainian government and replace it with a puppet regime that's going to do some kind of deal. So I think you're going to see this twin track, right? The Pac-Man chewing its way through Ukrainian cities and simultaneously GRU, which is Russian military intelligence, and Spetsnaz, which is their special operations forces, launching these kind of assassination and sabotage teams that we've been seeing to try to kill or capture the, you know, the group around Volodymyr Zelensky, the Ukrainian president.
And for context for the audience, because I don't think most Americans have heard the word Chechnya in decades, give the context on Chechnya, because it's actually very important to where we're about to go in terms of political military objectives. So yeah. What was the issue in Chechnya in the 1990s, and what actually is Chechnya?
So Soviet Union fell apart on Christmas Day, 1991. A number of former Soviet republics began to break away and declare their own independence. One of those was Chechnya, which is in the far south of Russia in the Caucasus. So the land isthmus that joins Russia to Georgia and then on to Azerbaijan and Iran. So that southern area. Those guys were irregulars, paramilitaries. Many of them had fought in Afghanistan. At the initial phase of the war, there was not a significant, religious extremism element to the conflict. It was really just nationalism. The leader of the breakaway republic was actually a former Soviet Air Force general, so it wasn't a religious war. But Boris Yeltsin at the time didn't see it as acceptable for a country like Chechnya or a region like Chechnya to break away from Russia. And so this was an internal operation against Russian citizens to try to prevent that breakaway of the republic. So again, if this is what they were willing to do to their own people, think about what they might be willing to do to Ukrainians here. It's also worth pointing out there were two wars in Chechnya, one from 1994 to 1996, and then the Yeltsin government backed off. And in that period between 96 and 99, radical Islamic groups did become more important in Chechnya as kind of an early example of what I've called the accidental guerrilla syndrome. Vladimir Putin, as his first act as prime minister and then president of Russia, launched another war in Chechnya, the one which did all that damage that we were talking about earlier. There've been persistent rumors in Russia that it was done on false pretenses, that FSB, which is the successor to the KGB, carried out various false flag incidents, blowing up apartment buildings in Moscow and elsewhere and blaming that on Chechen separatists. And that created the pretext, right, for the invasion. But I think the other, in addition to just that Pac-Man we've talked about, the other innovation that we saw from Vladimir Putin was making an ally of the, strongmen of Chechnya, and putting them in charge and letting them do the dirty work for him. And one of the fears we're seeing now in Ukraine is that there are actually quite a lot of Chechens in the attack groups that are coming into Ukraine. And the Chechen strongmen have sort of become like the shock troops of the Putin clique in Moscow. And I think we're going to see a bit more of that in Ukraine.
Yeah, I'd love for you to explain what the accidental guerrilla references. So you obviously, this is a concept that you've coined. You wrote a book on this back in 2008. So just explain what accidental guerrillas are.
Yeah, I mean, it's actually a pretty obvious, observation that, but you never lose money writing books on obvious shit, right? Can I say shit on your podcast? Sorry.
Please.
The idea is basically extremists, without necessarily having very much popular support, move into a population group that causes panic, triggers us to then go in and invade or disrupt in some way to try to deal with those extremists. And a very, very large number of people end up getting extremely pissed off, not because they support the extremists, but because we just invaded their country or we just droned their grandmother or something like that. And what you actually get is what I call accidental guerrillas, people that are fighting us, not because they hate us, but because we're in their face. And obviously the classic example of that was Iraq and Afghanistan, but we've seen it also in Somalia, in Pakistan, to some extent in Libya, a whole variety of other places. And I think, the application of that here is that, the line that the Russians have taken is that the Ukrainian state is dominated by a small clique of gangsters who are also neo-Nazis, which is kind of laughable.
With a Jewish president, their head, of course.
Jewish president who was elected with 73% of the vote. So obviously these are a rather unusual.
The craftiest Nazis we've ever seen at this point.
Devilishly clever, right? Voting in a Jewish president. The argument is like, there's a small number of extremists. We don't hate the Ukrainian people. We're just in there with what the Russians call a special military operation to deal with that. And of course, that's not how Ukrainians see it. And everyone's defending their families and their homes. And there's going to be a mass uprising slant insurgency against this. And it's just a European example of the accidental guerrilla syndrome.
Yeah, what's so useful there, and this is really where our experiences in Iraq and Afghanistan should teach us something. It's easy to put an ideological bent to everything that's happening. You could talk about insert hate us for our freedoms or radical Islamic terrorism. Obviously, that's a very real thing, you know, insert ISIS statement there. But the dynamic you're describing, especially when you're in some corner of Afghanistan, is actually deeply important. So like that's why this is a, like you said, it's simple, but you'd be shocked. Well, you wouldn't be shocked because you lived through this, but I think listeners would be shocked at how difficult it was to intuit such a simple point. So let's talk about the differences though between Grozny and Aleppo. So in those cases, what makes counterinsurgency and insurgency such a fascinating topic to me as a non-military person is it's a weird mix of military power, but economic power and political power. So actual objectives. So if you're looking at Chechnya in the 1990s, the political objective for Boris Yeltsin is to keep Russia together. You had all these breakaway republics in 1991, and it seems clear in 94, the Chechens missed their window and they've drawn a line in the sand. This isn't the Soviet Union. This is Russia. We are keeping Russia constituted together. And when they're making the calculus about leveling cities, destroying the breakaway republic, politically, that is fine because aside from just the human immorality of that strategy, it accomplishes the broader political goal of maintaining the integrity of Russia, preventing further breakaway republics. Once again, in Syria, broad objective, keeping their ally Bashar al-Assad in control of the country. If you level Aleppo, that's fine because he remains in power in that context. But here, though, what is the political objective that would necessitate the downsides of this strategy? Because like you said, every single second that you level a Ukrainian city, it gets harder and harder to maintain the denazification argument. It gets harder and harder and harder to impose a puppet government. And, you know, with every day, this becomes more of a Quisling, Vichy France type situation. So, and then the final point here would basically be, there's also the external factor of the massive sanctions and frank, just complete pullout and damage to the Russian economy. So the political military strategy they're pursuing is causing significant damage here. So can you just talk about this dynamic? Because that's where I think this breaks away from those two previous examples in terms of the dynamic.
Yeah, no, it absolutely does. And this is what I meant by saying that the Russians have thrown out their playbook, right, in the last week. I mean, this is a level of violence and a level of overt aggression from them that we've not seen at any time in the post-Soviet period, right? So it's a completely new behavior, although it's founded in Russian theory and Russian doctrine and ways of thinking about conflict that are longstanding. But it's a real departure from what they've done in the past. So as you say, the question is why, right? Now, the immediate pretext is this issue of denazification and so on. Let's set that aside for a minute. There is a real issue in the minds of Vladimir Putin and others about the encroachment of NATO into Russian borderlands, right? Keir Giles, who's one of the leading British Russia observers, quotes a Russian joke that Russians only think a border is secure when it has a Russian soldier standing on both sides of it, right? They want to actually project power beyond their borders in order to have some kind of a buffer. And remember, these guys have been invaded from the West four times in the last 200 years. Like, it's not an irrational fear, right? Secondly, and I quoted this in a book that I wrote a couple of years ago called The Dragons and the Snakes. The Russians were indeed told, or at least they think they were told, by about a dozen Western leaders right at the period of the end of the Cold War, that NATO would not expand one inch to the east. And in fact, they withdrew a thing called the Group of Soviet Forces in Germany, the most powerful military force on the continent, out of East Germany, back to Russia, on a promise given to them by a variety of people that we wouldn't expand NATO to the east. And there's been a lot of political debate about that in the US. But if you look at my book, I mean, I quote the actual archival diplomatic cables where we told each other that's what we told them, right? So it's not exactly secret. So the Russians believe that we have done the dirty by since then, incorporating a whole variety of former Warsaw Pact countries right up to Russia's actual border. Now, if you talk to the Czechs or the Poles or to others, they will say, you didn't come east to us, we ran west to you, right? And it isn't at all surprising that countries like Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, who suffered under, you know, horrific brutality from the Soviets for 50 years, would want a guarantee of being part of NATO, right? So, I think NATO's right to say, look, Russia doesn't get to tell these countries in Eastern Europe that they can't be part of NATO. Everyone has to have the freedom, to be able to join the alliance. But that's a different question from the sort of prudential alliance strategy question of whether it's smart to expand NATO right up to Russia's border, right? And I think you can say that it's legitimate for countries to join NATO, but simultaneously think that, what we've done has been objectively, quite threatening to the Russians. How they've chosen to react to that has been a variety of means. It's low profile, sort of what we often call gray zone maneuver until recently. What this is now is an overt attack on Ukraine, but I think we need to see it as not just targeting Ukraine, also sending a message to the Baltic states and to Finland and to Scandinavia and particularly to Poland and Romania that, if we can do this to the Ukrainians, a country of 44 million people, and we're willing to level these cities, think about what we could do to you, right? So it's almost like, sort of to use a bar fight and its analogy is they're picking the nearby little kid and beating the crap out of him in order to send a message to the powerful guys across the room, do not screw with us. And I think that's a way to think about it. It's not the only way, but that's certainly one factor, I think, in what's going on in Ukraine right now.
And I think that was a good summary. I have tiny quibbles with the framing, but I think broadly speaking, I think that articulates
I don't have a monopoly. Give us your
Just in this. So, as someone who's politics first, I'm very frustrated by this idea that, and once again, yes, various Western leaders did say various things to the Soviet Union regarding NATO expansion. But once again, the George H.W. Bush administration wasn't even reelected. There was no treaty. There isn't a direct Western document.
We never gave them a formal promise. It was a series of German leaders and French leaders, James Baker, people who are out of office a year later. Yeah, that's quite true. Yeah.
And my thing is, and this is why I get so frustrated with the Russians, because once again, to your point, Napoleon, Hitler, all these, authoritarian dictators have used Ukraine, Poland, Central Europe as a highway to get into Russia. And it's been completely devastating in all these various conflicts. So I am not questioning the fear. Once again, I'm driven by World War II. I understand why Russians are driven by World War II, but also World War I, which up until mm-hmm. the Soviet Union, they technically lost to Germany in terms of the Treaty of Brest-Litovsk. And then Napoleon. I understand all of that. But
don't forget the Crimean War, mate.
Yeah, and the Crimean War. Yeah, we're getting niche, but once again, an important war there. But here's where my frustration lies. If that assumption is true, every single move they've made has repudiated that story. So for example, the fact that up until now, European countries weren't even meeting their defense, 2% defense, but that should factor in. So once again, if it's the 1930s and Hitler is rising, obviously the Soviets were allied with Hitler for a quick second there, but if Hitler is rising and everyone's raising money and Poland is talking about recreating the Poland-Lithuanian Empire from the 15th century and President Biden is saying history is over, we're going to change Russia in a way that may have been more articulated in the 2000s, but was certainly done, aka in the world where President Obama specifically said, we will not intervene because of Crimea. Every single act Russia has taken since then, I think, has been fueled by complete and total arrogance. So to your point, if the message here was, hey, Baltics, Central European countries, don't mess with us, they sent the exact opposite message. Mm-hmm. Sweden and Finland, they're not going to join NATO. It isn't going to happen, I think. But in all but name, they are effectively now joining the Western alliance against Russia. They are sending weapons. You have Swedish and Finnish nationals like joining the Foreign Legion of Ukraine. Why then, given the story you just told, you know, in terms of you've told the story of, like, you know, American arrogance after 9/11. Mm-hmm. What is the hubristic poor analysis, in my perspective, that would lead you to make these miscalculations?
Yeah, great question. So we talked Napoleon. Let me give you a construct from Napoleon that I know you're aware of, and I'm sure your listeners are too. This notion of the strategic offensive, tactical defensive, right? So the idea is that you go to a place which, by just the nature of where you are, is offensive and threatening to an adversary, but then you adopt a defensive posture as a way to, because defense is stronger than attack. And this is a sort of Napoleon strategy that we've seen many times from him in his campaigns. The argument that you see from the Russians is NATO's on a strategic offensive, right? Over 20 years, it's moved closer and closer and closer, and it's encroaching, but it's in a period of a short-lived period of tactical weakness because of a variety of factors. Lack of defense spending, lack of unity across NATO nations until quite recently about things like sanctions, difference of opinion between the EU and NATO and the US, arguably a weak president, although we should come back to that because I think that's been blown out of proportion politically.
Are you referring to Biden or Trump?
Yeah, I mean, there's a sort of US political narcissistic argument about, like, Biden invited the invasion of Ukraine. Like, that may have been one factor, right? But I think there are a lot of other factors in the Russian calculus. And I think we can, you know, we risk blowing out of proportion the importance of who's in the White House to Russian strategy, right? I think they're more looking at the West just had a major screw up in Afghanistan. It's disunited. That COVID has brought significant domestic unrest in a lot of countries. You know, there's a variety of factors here that make it a good window of opportunity. Plus you've got Putin, who's 69. He's theoretically out of office in 2024, although he can extend that. He's got a limited closing window of opportunity to, you know, right what he sees as a massive historical wrong. And he thinks, you know what, when in the next 10 years am I going to have a better chance than now to move? The other factor for them is that the Ukrainians have been getting more and more weapons, becoming stronger, doubling the size of their military, or more than doubling it. And so, you know, it's almost a closing window of opportunity, right? Because if you don't move now, Ukraine gets stronger. I think all of that goes into the calculus. And I think that, you know, the notion of NATO expansion threatening Russia is not made up in the same way as the Nazi argument is, but it isn't the current top of mind, you know, for the Russians. I think it's for them, it was, we've got an opportunity here to do something about this and kind of set NATO back on its heels and reset the balance.
You've done a good job of establishing the timeline here. So there were the 20 years of Russian policy and NATO policy up until the invasion. And there seems to me to be the initial few days where Kyiv was expected to fall, surrender would have happened, the West would have backed down in the face of Russian aggression, but that didn't happen. So What I'm incredibly curious about is, what does this new playbook look like? Because if you are once again Vladimir Putin, we were talking about this at the start of the episode, and this is where the counterinsurgency bit comes in. Now this is turning into a protracted war. Because the quick decapitation, literal or figurative, of the Ukrainian leadership did not occur. And as I said before, with every single destroyed city block, the political legitimacy of any regime that follows installed by Putin weakens further. Also, it seems to me that with every single day, with every single additional bullet, plane, javelin, anti-tank weapon, the chances of the West or the broader democratic world, including countries like Japan, recognizing any puppet regime installed, gets weaker and weaker and weaker. So the chances of achieving that political goal, aka a Ukraine that's formally aligned towards Russia, while also the West backing off, seems weaker and weaker and weaker. So given that dynamic, you see, this seems to be the perfect breeding ground for an insurgency. So I'd love for you just to respond to that and then just talk about insurgency in this context when you have a powerful state against a weaker state.
Yeah. So, you know, of course, I'm going to see the potential for an insurgency here because that's what I do for a living, right?
And of course, I'm going to book you to talk about that. So there's a structural problem here.
Right. So take what I'm going to say with a grain of salt. But I think, you know, it's a country of 44 million people. It's a very large country by European standards. And the Russians right now have about 200,000 troops deployed, but a proportion of those are conscripts who need to rotate out. So let's call it 150,000-ish professional troops in country. That is nowhere close to the number you would need to secure a country like that against a serious resistance warfare opposition, right? I'm going to use the term resistance warfare rather than insurgency. It looks very similar on the ground, but there's a subtle difference, which is insurgency typically is a population rising up against its own government or an occupying power. And what we're seeing here is a sort of national resistance, probably with a government in exile in Western Europe somewhere, probably supported by NATO or the EU, at least unofficially. And it looks more like sort of World War II resistance movements against occupation rather than a traditional sort of fully internal insurgency on the ground.
Pause real quick, because this is actually very interesting historically. So for example, under your rubric, then Iraq is an insurgency because there is a successor government to Saddam Hussein. In Afghanistan, there obviously was at the start like Hamid Karzai, and then eventually Ashraf Ghani's government in Afghanistan that there is rebellion against. During the Vietnam War, you obviously have the Republic of Vietnam in the South. So that's why those examples, including the Viet Cong, that's an insurgency. But the point is, this is national resistance. Is that the correct framing here?
That's right. I mean, should also just point out there's a political element to that, right? I mean, I got in massive trouble when I worked for the State Department for pointing out that the war in Iraq, when we were the occupying power, looked a hell of a lot more like resistance warfare than insurgency, right? But of course, that makes us the Nazis in that analogy. So no one wants that, right? So we don't talk about it that way. But so let's use Iraq as an example. It was resistance against occupation until the point at which we put a fully sovereign Iraqi government in charge, you know, at the end of the surge. Since then, it's been an insurgency against that government, right? Afghanistan's a slightly more complicated case. Anyway, the reason I mention that is because NATO, in fact, the Swedes and the US put together, so not just NATO, put together a thing called the resistance operating concept a number of years ago, talking about how countries that were subject to the kinds of gray zone operations that the Russians have been doing might resist, right? And there's a lot of work being done by the RAND Corporation, think tank in DC and California, and by others on how that would look. What we've seen from the Russians is not the gray zone stuff we thought we were going to see. This is fully conventional. And so I think some of that resistance operating concept needs to be rethought a little bit. But the notion of sort of civilian resistance with a government in exile and a sort of remnant military force that's providing the backbone for an insurgency, I think that's very much in the cards for Ukraine. And we should note that Ukraine has 25 of what are called territorial brigades that exist across the country. And they're sort of like local, they're not exactly National Guard, but they're sort of local military that are there to defend an area rather than act in an offensive fashion. And they work with local defense leagues in the community to create like a network defense. And that's very much coming into play now. That's why we're seeing a lot of the civilian resistance working so well, because they've got this structure in place to resist against the Russians. I think the chances of the Russians suppressing that are next to zero, even with huge firepower. There's already a significant peace movement in Russia, 7,000 arrests or so in the last week. You know, it's going to be very difficult for them to suffer lots of body bags coming home to Russia and not have significant issues back home. And I think it'd be hard for them to sustain that. So I think what you find the Russians trying to do most likely is what they did in the Georgian War of 2008, where they captured a key port and another city that allowed them to claim a victory, right? And basically allowed them to say, okay, we got what we came for. We taught you a lesson. Don't do it again, or we'll come back, right? And so that gave them a sort of face-saving off-ramp, right, to to get out of the situation they'd gotten themselves in. So right now they're trying to envelop Kyiv. They're trying to capture Kharkiv and to secure the southern coast of Ukraine. And if they, I think they're going to succeed in securing a land corridor from Russia to the Crimea. And if they take Kharkiv or even Kyiv, I think at that point they would say, right, we've got what we came for. Now we're negotiating. We're going to leave, but we've taught you a lesson, right? I'll just flag one other sort of deus ex machina possibility here, which is China, right? The Chinese have kept their powder dry so far. And it's entirely possible that we might actually see China come out of the woodwork in the next week or two to resolve the conflict and act as kind of a quote unquote honest broker, thereby putting themselves in a dominant position, much in the same way that the US did during the Suez Crisis in the 1950s. If you readers or listeners,
can you explain what happened there?
Yeah, also 1956 happened to occur at the same time as the Hungarian uprising against the Soviet Union, but Britain and France, and in concert with Israel, invaded the Suez Canal zone in Egypt against the new nationalist government of Gamal Abdel Nasser, the new anti-Western president of Egypt. And the British and the French very much expected the Eisenhower administration to come off the benches and support them. They didn't coordinate with the US. The US was tied up trying to handle Hungary at the same time. And rather than support its European allies, the US instead came and said, we're not supporting this. This is crazy. Everybody go back in your box. The US resolved the crisis. And the British certainly and the French felt betrayed by the Eisenhower administration. But that really stamped the dominance of the US in that early Cold War period that, you know, US is the top dog. It doesn't hunt in a pack with the European empires, and it's going to be the one that decides outcomes. And so there's a less ambitious Chinese policy here, which might be to just support, support Russia in order to troll own the West, right? And thereby disrupt the Western dominated world order. That's a possibility. A more ambitious thing, I think, would be to come out and say, okay, we don't have a dog in this fight. We're the honest broker. We're a UN Security Council permanent member. And we are now going to take the responsible course and solve this crisis. And at the end of that, China is the dominant player globally, right? I don't see Xi Jinping saying anything that would lead you to think he's going to do that anytime soon, but it's a possibility we should be thinking about.
Yeah, it's fascinating. There's so many things I want to hit here in our remaining time, but one, it seems to me the Chinese severely miscalculated by taking that very public meeting with Putin before this happened. That picture of Xi and Putin together, smiling, almost even smirking, was a disaster, because now that's why you're seeing, it seemed to, the best case scenario. So like I said, let's go back to the example of Grozny specifically, West Syria, because that obviously had deeply international implications. That was inter-Russian conflict. Mm-hmm. The world may have condemned it. People may have said bad things about Boris Yeltsin. But that being said, it was an internal matter. And when Putin was trying to go around with his ahistorical and unproductive essays saying, we are one people, Ukrainian national identity is a lie, it doesn't exist, it seems to me that that was aimed at making this a Russian issue. But the second you have Russia and China together in a deeply ideological nature like this, that's why you're seeing Japan explore the idea of having nuclear, US nuclear missiles on their territory. That's why you're seeing Shinzo Abe talking about rearming the Japanese military. They internationalized this conflict by taking that meeting. And to your point, it's very difficult to see Xi able to argue he's an honest broker, given the leaks and the fact that everyone now knows that Russia informed China of this invasion happening before it occurred. Yeah, the difference to your Eisenhower point, Ike did not know, or to the degree that Xi knew. This is as if, Anthony Eden I don't think it was Charles de Gaulle at the point, but whoever was in charge of France at that point, and then the prime minister of Israel traveled to DC, took a meeting with Eisenhower in front of the White House, and then Ike claimed to not know and be an honest broker. Once again, why? Let's go to dragons and snakes real quick. It seems to me that autocracies have made terrible political calculations for the last 4 years. And this seems to be at the height of one of those. What do you think is going on there?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think it's interesting because I was having a conversation yesterday with a bunch of British military leaders. And one of them posed a really good question, which was, you know, have the Russians seen us adapting to their hybrid form of warfare and decided, you know what, the Americans and the Allies have gone hybrid. Let's go back to conventional, right? So the argument I make in Dragons and the Snakes is that after 1991, the Gulf War, we basically showed everybody how not to fight us, right? If you go out conventionally in the open, arrayed in the way that Saddam did in 1991, the outcome is going to be some variant of the highway of death, right? It's just not a good way to operate. My friend H.R. McMaster says there's two ways to fight the US, asymmetric and stupid, right? And, you know, people have realized that. And so what I chronicle in that book is how Russia, China, Iran, a number of others have adapted to come up with ways of operating that invalidate our very conventional, you know, battlefield-centric way of war. And arguably, that's what that Russian playbook has been for the last 20 years. And we've been reacting to that. It's probably my fault as much as anybody else's by saying, hey, there's all this gray zone stuff going on. We need to get better at counter hybrid. We need to get better at information warfare, you know, focusing on that. And it's possible, as this British general said yesterday, that the Russians saw us adapting to that and went, oh, okay, well, let's just go back to conventional, right? And I think that's a factor for sure. I think also this perception of Western weakness in the wake of the debacle in Afghanistan is another factor. And a perception that we tend to rely overly heavily on economic measures rather than military measures. And, you know, I do think we miscalculated a bit there, particularly by saying right up front, we're taking all military measures off the table. We left ourselves with only economic sanctions. And, you know, I'm not 100% sure that Putin sees the oligarchs losing their money as a bad thing, right? I mean, they're a rival power center to Putin. Their power comes from their money. It might be a feature, not a bug, right? For Putin, if the oligarchs get weakened here. So I think we sort of took the military, you know, and made them better at doing counter hybrid, which by definition meant that we weren't so focused on the kind of conventional threat that we're seeing now. We also telegraphed weakness and disunity. I'm not talking about President Biden here. I'm talking about a broader set of issues across the full European alliance, of which the president just won. But, you know, and there was this window of opportunity and they thought, you know what, let's have a go. And I think that's what we're seeing now.
You know, that's such a fascinating argument because it gets to why this is a obviously morbid topic, but it's really interesting. On a pure military level, I agree. Ideally, you would have had more strategic ambiguity as to whether or not we would intervene in Ukraine if Russia invaded. We have that sort of ambiguity when it comes to Taiwan. And in that case, I think that probably plays a stabilizing role in terms of our relationship with China. The issue, though, is that in terms of US domestic politics, what I can tell you, though, is that Biden taking that option off the table effectively prevented him from being undercut. So this no longer, so on a domestic politics level, this changed this. Him taking troops off the table entirely put all of the onus on Putin, which I think domestically, this isn't maybe the optimal military result, but I think this was the optimal result for keeping the US engaged on Ukraine's side. But you have to balance, and that's why it's a fascinating thing to balance.
Well, I think that's true, right? And I've noticed people on the right likening President Biden to Neville Chamberlain, right? Which frankly is a little bit unfair to Neville Chamberlain, right? I mean, Neville Chamberlain after Munich was the guy who rearmed the British Empire, right? He was the guy who declared war on Hitler after the invasion of Poland. And arguably part of Chamberlain's strategy in 38 and 39 was maneuvering Hitler into a position where he was in the moral wrong and the West was morally right, so that when the time came, they had the support of the world in fighting the Nazis. And that's not a sort of historical revisionist point of view. That's like the understood, historical record now with respect to Chamberlain. And I think, you know, appeasement has a bad name, rightly, because weakness can be provocative. It can telegraph, hey, there's a window of opportunity to attack. But I think there's a trade-off, right, between being morally in the right, giving you the basis to be able to retaliate, in an effective way, versus, leaving it too long to react. And it's a judgment call. And I think to the red line issue, like taking military stuff off the table and telegraphing exactly what our red lines were, that has a bad name because of what happened in Syria in 2013, when President Obama had very clearly stated a red line and then failed to follow through when the Syrians launched that chemical attack on their own population. But it has a long history in US policy, going back to the Korean War, actually, the famous incident where the State Department accidentally left South Korea off their list of places they would defend against communism. And Stalin read that and went, oh, okay, maybe we can move on South Korea. And everyone was very scarred by that. And, we've tried to be very clear about what our red lines are in most cases since. But as you rightly point out, there's some value to creative ambiguity, right? If you're playing the kind of strategy that Putin has been playing, one of the key factors for you is understanding what's going to trigger a response and what form is that response going to take, right? It's almost like one of those Hollywood movies where the bad guys hit the bank vault and they're like, right, the cops will be here in 7 minutes with like 15 guys. If you can map the parameters of how a response is going to look, that allows you to plan. Again, on the right, people are saying, well, Trump was such a great president, that's why Putin didn't move on Ukraine. Yeah, that's possible. Certainly, Biden telegraphed some weakness when he said, a minor incursion would be okay, but I think there was another factor with Trump, which was the guy was just so unpredictable, right? Like, mm-hmm. If you don't know how the president's going to react, one day he does nothing, another day he's like, right, let's kill Soleimani, and whatever he sees first thing in the morning when he wakes up drives his policy agenda for the day. It's really hard to plan that kind of strategy against a president who's so unpredictable. When you get a more, quote, responsible president who's, when elected, Biden said he wanted a predictable and stable relationship with Russia, right? So clearly that predictability was a key factor for President Biden. Well, that just makes us more predictable for this kind of approach. But I think to your very first point in the whole conversation, Russians have badly miscalculated here, right? And this is probably not where they wanted to be. It's not the reaction they're expecting. And I think now they're forced to reorganize their entire campaign on the fly, and they're historically not very good at that.
So yeah, we've got 15 minutes left. So I want to not rapid fire, take as long as you need, but I just want to hit these very apparent questions. So your background is obviously in the Australian military. And whenever I speak with people from your age cohort, a lot of their mentalities were shaped during the Cold War. So they were, H.R. McMaster, famously, like when he's at West Point, his expectation is he's going to become a tank commander and go to West Germany to protect against a Soviet invasion. There's really that frame there. Your frame when you were coming in is there is this Russian Soviet bear. It's very powerful. They probably, we all know, like U.S. troops referred to as tripwire forces. Western Europe, sans nuclear weapons, is conquered by the Soviets. I've been struck by how incompetent the Russian military seems to be. And push back on this is untrue, but I think what feels frustrating to me is obviously I don't support U.S. intervention because of the nuclear risk. But it seems to me that if the U.S. did decide to intervene, this Russian army is not the Soviet army, even with Putin's 20 years of reform. So this army he has right now is a better army than it was during the 1990s. There are conscripts, but there is even fewer conscripts than there used to be. What is going on with the Russian army when it comes to these logistical issues, when it comes to the inability to just perform, not, the street-to-street fighting, but the basic details of logistics in those parts?
Yeah, so we should come back to nukes, right? Because the Russians think about nuclear weapons completely differently from how we do. But in terms of the conventional Russian forces, there were significant reforms known as the New Look reforms between 2008 and about 2011. And a number of features of that was reacting to what the Russians thought were poor performances in Georgia and in Chechnya. And they certainly are dramatically better than they were then. They are also better equipped with more advanced weaponry, and you know, they're just a more professional, better organized force than they were. But a lot of what we're seeing from them is the classic screw-ups that we saw, you know, going back again to the Soviets in the Cold War. Bad logistics, sticking to the roads, not planning in a way that allows you to be flexible when the situation changes, heavy reliance on firepower, use of conscripts in sort of overly simplistic maneuvers where junior commanders don't have a lot of freedom to maneuver, attempt to quickly overpower using special forces, and then when that fails, going to the sledgehammer. You know, these are all things that we've seen from the Russians and from the Soviets before them, going back to, you know, when I was a junior officer studying, you know, the Russians in Afghanistan. I mean, this is the stuff that they do. It is surprising, I think, that they haven't been more professional. But I don't think it's that surprising when you look at their previous combat performance in a variety of theaters. So, you know, we can talk nukes as well, but I think the
conventionally, please, nukes, go there.
Yeah, well, so Russia has about 4,500 nukes, significantly more than the US does. More importantly, though, the Russians have a much more extensive tactical nuclear weapon or non-strategic nuclear weapon stockpile, as little as 0.1 to 0.3 of a kiloton. So like, you know, the Hiroshima bomb was 15 kilotons. So we're talking about much smaller weapons, and the Russians
battlefield
nuclear weapons, right? And the Russians have always regarded nuclear weapons as kind of a species of large artillery, rather than how we look at them, which is a sort of militarily unusable species of super weapon that, you know, would lead to the end of the world if you were to use them. That's not how the Russians think about them. Russian nuclear strategy, this is a disputed concept, by the way. The notion of retaliatory or de-escalatory strikes, something some people call escalate to de-escalate.
That sounds like an oxymoron.
I know. Yeah. We could get into it, but it's a big debate in the Russia watcher community. But back in the late 1990s, early 2000s, Russian nuclear strategy involved the notion that in the event of a major non-nuclear attack on the nation, that the use of a first strike nuclear weapon would be considered acceptable. And the notion there was, you know, imagine you've got a US force in the middle of the Atlantic sailing to Europe to be part of a war against Russia. What if the Russians nuke the ships at sea, right?
With like one of the tactical nuclear weapons.
Yeah, or even a larger one, right? You know, it's at sea, there's no civilians, there's limited environmental damage. It isn't a city that you're knocking out. And the calculus was it would be irrational for the US to retaliate and trigger a global thermonuclear exchange just because they lost a fleet at sea, right? But they wouldn't necessarily send another one. I mean, wow, you know, it's a big gamble, right? But that was the sort of discussion at the time, that it might be rational to use nukes on that kind of a target. More tactically, in a land theater, a lot of the Russian missiles, like the Iskander-Ms that have been fired in the last few weeks, can be either nuclear or non-nuclear and can be used to sort of clear a path for a ground force to push through. Now, think about if you're pushing an armored column of Russians through an area that you just nuked, like a lot of those people are going to die, right, from just the radiation. So it's an incredibly cynical and brutal way to treat your own troops. And I think it'd be a huge step for the Russians to do that in terms of losing popular support. But I'll just say it's in their doctrine, right? It's something that they could theoretically think of doing in extremis. And it's very different from how we think about nuclear weapons.
And, you know, it's interesting. We're getting to the counterinsurgency part. So historically, at a theoretical level, I don't need to educate you you wrote a book called Counterinsurgency. So apologies for the condescension, but historically an important factor in successful insurgencies has been borders, in the sense that why do Filipinos ultimately fail to defeat the U.S. after the Spanish-American War. After the war there, it's because it's an island, and at a practical level, and they're not supplied by anyone, and the U.S. effectively was able to do that. But what do you see in Vietnam? You see the border with China, where supplies pour in, where for a variety of obviously nuclear and Cold War reasons, the U.S. is not going to interdict or launch a war against there. You know, in Pakistan, you have that with the Afghan war. In Iraq, you have that with Syria. So there's this consistent history of successful insurgencies, and this didn't quite work in Iraq, but insurgencies that could wage protracted, costly struggles that limit the political objectives of the occupier. In this case, you have this border with Western Europe, not just Western Europe, but NATO countries, where once again, you're seeing supplies come in. How does this dynamic play into Russian thinking? Because this isn't just like, oh, you're going over the mountains into Afghanistan. This is like straight up easy land borders, where on Twitter, we're seeing people say X number of bullets are crossing into the country now. How are they thinking about that?
Yeah, well, the short answer to that is we don't know, right? Because the Russians haven't been very public about their current thinking on a potential protracted war. In fact, to the extent that we know what they were thinking, it seems they were hoping and expecting a short war. But if we do get into a protracted conflict, you're absolutely right that what counterinsurgency people call sanctuary or safe haven on the other side of the border will immediately become an issue for the Russians, even if they're able to secure the whole of Ukrainian territory, which isn't necessarily feasible, right? Then they're going to have a significant problem with infiltration of fighters and weapons and medical supplies and advisors and all that kind of stuff from Western Europe. And it's very, very difficult to control, a country when you have that. Now, one possibility might be that instead of trying to occupy all of Ukraine, there's a town called Dnipro, which is on the Dnieper River, which runs through the middle of Ukraine. And it's possible that they might try to link up the southern and northern thrusts. I mean, if you look at a map right now, it looks kind of like a set of jaws closing on Ukraine from the east, and the sort of teeth, right? The thrust north from Crimea and south from Kharkiv. You could potentially link that up along the Dnieper River, and then Russia controls eastern Ukraine, and it has a river and a defendable border, more defendable, that would allow it to try to control that portion of the country. Still an enormous challenge, right? You're still talking about 20 odd million people, but more so than trying to control the whole of the country. I don't think the Russians want to do that. I think they want to do a deal. They want a new regime in Kyiv that will do that deal. And short of that, they want to find some kind of face-saving way to declare victory and leave. But if they do get drawn into a protracted counterinsurgency, that's the sort of, extreme measures they might have to think about.
And this is where it gets fascinating, because once again, it seems to me the takeaway is this was premised on a three-day shock and awe style campaign. With every single day, with every single Ukrainian death, with at this point, if Zelensky, you could have, I'm not sure the degree to which the claims about an assassination attempt on Zelensky in the first few days were accurate or not, but should that happen at this point, that seems to be a political disaster. If I'm Russia, I'd much rather exile him than cause a death in terms of a pure martyrdom issue. But at this point, though, why wouldn't there be an insurgency against the Russian puppet regime? Because it seems to me that you're talking about an off ramp, but it seems to me after they went beyond the breakaway republics and after they couldn't finish it in 3 days, we're way past the off ramp in terms of what their long term political interest would be, aka a stable, friendly regime that's leaned towards Russia away from the West.
Yeah, so you're making a great point, and I hadn't actually thought of that, but it is a very sensible way to think about it, right? That, from the Russian standpoint, what's better, right? A Finlandized or neutralized Ukrainian government still headed by Zelensky, or some kind of Quisling regime that Ukrainian people don't see as legitimate?
And one quick thing that also would not be seen by the West as legitimate. Right. At this point, especially if Zelensky escapes or some form of government exile exists. Yeah. If Russia's a pariah state, that Quisling government is even more of a pariah state.
Absolutely. And, you know, right now, Zelensky is arguably the leader of the free world, right? And he's a hero to a lot of people. And if he were to come out and say, look, we fought hard, we fought well, we're doing a deal in order to save Ukraine, it'd be very hard for people not to support that, right? And so, I think you're quite right about that. I think that would be the ideal outcome from the Russian standpoint. But again, that's not necessarily how these things go, right? It may very well be that there's a GRU Spetsnaz team out there right now hunting Zelensky who don't have communications and are going to whack the guy just because that was the last direction they were given, right? Or he gets caught up in a bombing or whatever. Like once you start a war, you know, as George W. Bush could tell you, right? The outcome by definition is unpredictable. And I think, you know, there's a point at which the Russians don't get to decide what happens here, you know? But yeah, I think Quisling regime, not a good outcome. Zelensky doing a deal, obviously the ideal outcome, but would the deal that Zelensky would be willing to do be acceptable to the Russians? And we're all rooting for the Ukrainians here, but you know, it's ultimately going to be their call.
So last two questions. One would be the US obviously spent 20 years fighting insurgencies. What have the Russians learned from our failures and successes in that mission?
Both the Russians and the Chinese, I think, have watched us very carefully. There was a period in the early 2000s where the Russians were very friendly in their attempt to offer us advice. And there's actually a Russian general staff history of the war in Afghanistan that was circulated around that time frame is hugely useful series of lessons. And we were sort of arrogantly blowing off the Russians and saying, you know, we're the Americans, don't you know, like we're gonna show you guys what you should have done. There's a certain amount of schadenfreude, I'm sure, in Russia when we got our asses kicked last year. So, you know, I think they've watched what we've done. They've realized we've got a number of weaknesses, right? And they have, I think, calculated that in the wake of that 20 years of conflict, we no longer have the stomach or the internal cohesion in the West to sustain another protracted conflict against Russia. And I think they miscalculated on the basis of not understanding Ukrainian resolve. And the fact that the Ukrainians have fought so hard means that the economic sanctions will now have time to bite, right? And it may be that part of Putin's calculation about sanctions was, yeah, you can impose sanctions, but we will have overthrown the Ukrainian regime before they can have any effect. So they're rather meaningless. Well, that's not true anymore, right? So I think that they've watched what we did. They've watched the struggle. They've learned how to oppose us, but I think they've miscalculated in this particular case.
Do you have 5 minutes past the hour?
Sure, mate. Yeah, whatever you need. Yeah.
All right, cool. Because you keep, when people say interesting things, my specialty is follow up, so I have to go there. Let me clarify what I meant. By learn from our 20-year experience, I meant counterinsurgency. History, once again, don't have to tell you this history, but the history of the second Iraq war is we basically spend a decent part of the first term of the Bush administration denying there's an insurgency. You have Donald Rumsfeld, he's very recalcitrant. And then with the surge, Petraeus, your experience at the State Department, et cetera, you see this shift to there is an insurgency, we have to deal with this, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So what from the counterinsurgency experience have they learned?
Yeah, well, I think a lot, right? And we've seen significant evolution in Russian counterinsurgency technique, right? Since that early period in Chechnya, where we talked about with sledgehammers, you know, building alliances with local partners who may want to work with them. That's a lesson we saw them applying in Syria, but also in Chechnya in the second war. I think the other big issue that we saw them applying in Syria was doing local peace deals with communities as a way of ending conflict in a particular area and getting people to leave, right? So there's been a sort of evolution in their approach. But remember that there's like a two-speed Russian military, right? There are the GRU and the Special Forces and SSO, which is their equivalent of like Delta Force, and a whole variety of like high-end players who know how to do this stuff well. And then there's the big conscript you know, heavy metal army that isn't so good at it, much like we had, right, when we went into Iraq. And I think their ability to adapt the larger force to this kind of conflict is going to be slower, right, than what they've done in the last 20 years. Yeah.
Something people are no doubt curious about are tactical decisions around weapons. So obviously the key weapons in Iraq and Afghanistan are the IED, the IFP tactics that take advantage of the nature of U.S. forces. So the IFP, you know, this is a special type of IED that was basically supported by the Iranian Revolutionary Guard that was particularly devastating to our early armored forces. You have the MRAPs come in. It's a little complicated. The point is like that the IED was, like you said, the way to harm American troops wasn't standing and fighting on the highway. It was let them come into the city and then use IEDs and IFPs to really devastating accounts. We're seeing in social media lots of pictures of Molotov cocktails. Now there's a propaganda war going on, obviously. I think that's very important. The Molotov cocktail, especially to Western audiences, is very important. Very, very important imagery. AK-47s that also has, you know, as this weapon of like national liberation, of very, you know, it's on the flag of like some African country. This is an important idea. But what do you think are the ideal ways of tactically combating the Russian army? Because it seems like the Molotov cocktail doesn't seem to actually be it, given the dynamic of the fight you're facing.
Yeah, Molotov cocktails are pretty good against dismounted infantry who haven't been trained to deal with them. But a trained infantry unit knows how to douse somebody that's, you know, been set on fire. It's part of the counter-riot training that people do. Older design armored vehicles are vulnerable if you hit them on the air intake with a Molotov cocktail, and that can actually, you know, snuff out the engine and cause them to stall. But you got to be pretty lucky.
You got to get close too. Like that, it seems like that. So it's not just the dousing. It's like that tactic specific. That requires some close quarters.
Yeah, it's not just a question of how far can you throw a 5-pound wine bottle full of gasoline. It's how far can you throw it when someone's shooting at you, right?
Yeah.
And you know, it's tricky, right? But certainly I think the more significant weapon, and one that is flooding in now to Ukraine, and something that the Ukrainians are going to have to husband very carefully if they want to sustain an effort, is the man-launched or man-portable, as they describe it. It's mostly men, I guess. Anti-armor weapons. So the Javelin, FGM 148, which is American design, I think called the NLAW, which is the British equivalent of that, variety of older weapon systems that are coming in from Finland and elsewhere, essentially are what are known as top attack weapons. So you can launch them from a distance, they climb and then attack a target from above. And that's typically where tanks are quite weak. Tanks and armored vehicles are weak in their top armor. The Russians have done a number of adaptations to make their armored vehicles more defendable against those. And I think, you know, that has improved it, but they're still quite vulnerable. And you can look at just the pictures of destroyed Russian armored vehicles from the last week, many of which were knocked out by these kinds of things. Tactically, it's about ambushing rather than IEDs, right? So you've got a Russian military that's very roadbound, and you attack the front and the rear vehicle, pin them in that street, and then just go to town with, you know, heavy weapons on them. That's the sort of stuff that was done to us a lot in Iraq. The Russians are certainly aware of that problem, but it's something I think we would be likely to see. And then the other thing, and it's a, you know, dirty little fact about insurgency, you don't necessarily gain the most mileage by attacking Russian combat troops in the front. You gain the most mileage by attacking logistics units, support units, and frankly, the civilian population that supports the Russians, right? That's why insurgencies rapidly turn into civil wars and get very violent and grubby, because the easy target to attack is civilians. So I think that potentially is where it goes. And I think the Ukrainian government, which right now very much has the moral high ground, is going to want to preserve that and is going to want to avoid getting involved in any of those kinds of attacks. But it's really hard to avoid getting sucked into that. And of course, there's the problem of fake news and Russian propaganda and false flags and all that in terms of presenting, you know, falsehood as truth. And I think we might see a lot of that play out as an important element in the event of a conflict like this.
Well, Dave, this has been incredible, a real masterclass. We actually move a lot of books on this show. So could you, you've written a million things. Can you just shout out? Because this is weird. Like, you know, books you've written back in 08 are actually quite relevant right now.
So can
you
just,
it's right, the cycle there. So can you, wanted to talk more about 2008, 2010, Dave, even 2013, Dave, than 2020, Dave. But can you just shout out all of your books? We'll put them in our bookshop and go from there.
We should do this again sometime, right? I mean, the conflict isn't going away. And I think we'll be able to have another. So my first book was called The Accidental Guerrilla, which we've talked about already, and has a fair bit in it about how, you know, counterinsurgency and insurgency work. I've written a number of books about ISIS and the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and Libya and so on. The most recent one that I think is relevant here is called The Dragon and the Snakes, which has a big Russia chapter. I actually went the entire length of the Russian-Norwegian border with a special unit that sort of hides in the woods up there and saw a lot of really interesting Russian stuff up close. And talked a lot in that book about the evolution of Russian thinking since the Cold War. And there's also a China chapter in that book where I talk about what the Chinese have learned in part by watching the Russians. So, The Dragons and the Snakes is that book. Oxford University Press 2020 came out just in time for the pandemic. I think it's probably going to need a rewrite once we see how this thing goes in Ukraine.
Well, Dave, best of luck in the coming weeks, and we will definitely do this again. Thanks for joining us on the show.
Thanks, Marshall. Really great.